Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
What's up, guys? Terry Foy, Mac Neer, Dan Aber, and Kevin Brown. We are back at the Inside Lacrosse Roundtable. This time we're talking about college lacrosse. The 2026 season is upon us. The top 50 players are here. We're going to dive in. We're going to talk about the top 20. But before we do, we're going to go around and everybody's going to talk about who they chose as number one and why. Matt, you go first.
Yeah, this is a weird year, right? Like, there's not this clear number one player in the country. Last year was CJ Kirst. And even, you know, when you think back a few years, there's Brendan O'Neill, Connor Schellenberger. It's one or two guys. You know, we had four different people get votes for number one of our staff and our collective group that voted on this. And you really can make a solid argument for anyone. I went with the guy who became the number one overall, Joey Spallina, attackman, Syracuse. There's been so much chatter around his game over the course of the past few years in terms of just, can he deliver in the big moment? I think that game against Princeton proved that he can deliver on the biggest stage. You know, Syracuse is on that short list of teams that we think are competing for a national championship. The guy's going to break Mikey Powell's record. That's as good as you can be. You know, there are some defensive options, and this is really a defensive year in terms of the top-end talent. But I think you can make an argument either way for some of those defensive guys that you guys are going to talk about, whereas I think the clear best attackman, the guy who has the most potential to do great championship weekend things, is Joey Spallina.
I voted for Will Schaller, Maryland defenseman, and my affinity for Schaller stems from his hockey player playmaking ability. And the moment of the season for me was the end of their regular season win over Notre Dame in Atlanta. And I was on the field, and I thought that the greasy plays he made in order to get his team possession and secure that win were emblematic of, you know, a player whose contributions went beyond just his on-ball defensive prowess, which is also at the highest levels. So a little bit of a non-conventional pick. I've been known for these types of non-conventional picks, but ultimately he ended up being number two overall, so clearly it wasn't that non-conventional. Dan, you picked the guy who was number three in the final top 50.
Yeah, so I'm a bit of a contrarian here, which is a surprise to me, but I picked Aiden McGuire, and the exercise was who's the best player in college lacrosse, and when that question was asked to me, I said, well, I think it's Aiden McGuire. I think he's one of the best athletes, period, in Division I, and not only does he excel at his position of short stick defensive midfielder, but he can step into a variety of roles, and we saw it last year with Duke, where it's like, we need a hero on offense. Aiden McGuire steps up and scores an OT winner against Richmond in a pretty critical game for Duke. And I'm honestly surprised that he didn't get as many votes for number one or in the top five as I thought, because I think when you ask around, I think who's the best player in college lacrosse, which then leads into the conversation, who's going first in the PLL draft next year? I think Aiden McGuire is on that short list. For me, he's the best player in college lacrosse. It was not an easy decision with some of the guys we got here, but I feel good being the contrarian here. So
it's a solid take. It's you know, out there, reigning midfielder of the year named by USILA. Like, for a defensive midfielder to have the season that he had, kudos to you for ranking him number one. We had a couple other submissions that also ranked him the top overall player. I couldn't do it. Like, I think there's other defensive midfielders that are similar in terms of their impact on winning. You think of Eric Kolar out of Maryland, doesn't put up as gaudy stats, but his impact on that end, Jack Pilling, co-captain down at Richmond. So I sided with Matt here with picking Joey Spallina as my top overall player for all the reasons that you mentioned. He's the biggest name. And look, we don't need to overthink it. Coming off a 90-point season, he was our sixth-ranked player last year. And like you said, that eight-point performance against Princeton in the quarterfinals. And just watching him in the fall, he's ready to come back for more and lead this group of Syracuse that's got a lot of expectations coming into 2026.
And to be fair, though, I'm not as bullish on Syracuse as a lot of people are in terms of, you know, them going all the way. I think that they are certainly, you know, in this tier of teams that we consider contenders. But, you know, if I'm picking a national champion right now, I am picking Maryland, which kind of goes against, you know, the pick I just made. And kind of represents that this year is like one of those like Maryland-esque years, right? When there's not a clear like alpha offensively, you expect Maryland, you know, they talk about the faceless offense that they have, to be a team that's there in the end. But for me, you know, it's not a Spallina fit. I think Spallina's cast around him needs to improve a little bit. I'm not sure that it necessarily did this year, but Spallina does elevate everything with that program, with his play. I think the critiques of him are just a result of the fact that Syracuse is the most dedicated fan base, the loudest voices, the most media attention, everything you want to say, all those criticisms about him. And some of them were maybe valid early in his career. But, you know, he's the guy that I want with the ball if I'm going to be building a team.
As we mentioned, we're going to go through each of the top 20 players. Number three, Sean Light, Notre Dame defenseman. We've already mentioned him in the context of this being a class with more known quantities at the defensive end of the field. One of the things that I think is interesting about Light's profile is effectively the questions around Notre Dame and what they have to do offensively and how they have to rebuild. And we'll get to some of those guys later in the conversation. But Light, incredibly well-known quantity, you know, two-year starter, won a national championship as a freshman, and certainly was really good as a sophomore as well. Matt, what do you think about and where do you see Sean Light fitting into this group at the top?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I think all of us would say that he had a down year by his standards last year, but he was still the Coe Schmeiser Award winner, which I think just speaks to the, like, unthinkable standard that he has set. You know, he can do anything. And, you know, what I just loved is, like, how he stepped in there right away and has been that consistent force. You kind of, like, you know, he looked danger in the eye and just didn't flinch. The way that he just got in there, you know, I remember him guarding Joey Spallina in one of his early games 2 years ago and the way he just handled that. He certainly got potential to be the best player in college lacrosse. I couldn't vote him number one just because I thought he was coming off a year that wasn't his best. But clearly his not best year is better than at least 46 other players in the country. So, you know, that's pretty darn good.
We already talked about McGuire coming in at number four. Owen Duffy at number five. Dan, I know he's a player that you have a lot of thoughts on. What was your take on where Owen Duffy landed?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, top five, I would say, is probably, you know, a consensus. I think everybody thinks that this is probably one of the best players in college cross, period. Just a truly dynamic dodger, able to orchestrate an offense like very few players can. And I'm expecting a huge year for him alongside Dom Petromala. Like, you know, we've talked about in other videos and other conversations that this is a really big year for North Carolina in terms of like where they can go and where they can finish. And, you know, Duffy and Petromala are finally in their upperclassmen years. So the expectation for them is going to be higher than it has been for the past 2 years. And after what we saw from Duffy in the World Cup game or the World Games this past summer, you know, I think that he's primed for, you know, another great season and probably expanding on his point total. But I think the question for the Tar Heels now is, you know, how far can we go in the postseason? So
yeah, if anything, that U20 World Championship, well, he had more hunger coming off a disappointing first round loss as well at home. You got to expect Owen Duffy coming off a 79-point season. If he increases that point total, like getting close to the triple digits, he's certainly capable of it. He's that dynamic of a dodger and scorer. And look, his team needs him to put up these balanced numbers. He had 40 goals, 39 assists last year because they need him to run the offense. Everything goes through him, and it's going to need to be that way. He's going to need more help. He's getting some talented freshmen coming in, but yeah, it doesn't take anything away from him being a top five player this year.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, he's in a very unique position where I think he's actually criticized for doing too much. Like, I think that a lot of people, when they looked at Carolina last year, they said there's too much on Duffy and Petromala and they're not getting help from anywhere else. So, like you said, like, if they can actually get some more contributors and some more consistent play from some of their younger players and some of the other players that were younger last year but are getting older, like, this team has very high potential.
One thing with that is, you know, yes, that has been the criticism. It's too much Duffy Petro. Mm-hmm. But this is, like, really the healthiest they've been together in the offseason is this year because they've, you know, kind of been staggering injuries back and forth. So the fact that the two of them are going to be, like, even better as a duo, presumably, and then add in this freshman class and some of the other changes that they're making, you know, They're going to go far, and Duffy's going to be the reason.
Kev, at number six, Ryan Goldstein, Cornell attackman. You've both reported a lot on this team, got an opportunity to see him in the fall as well. And also, I think it's fair to say you have pretty strong affinity for Goldstein's game. How'd you feel about where he slotted in at number six and what he means to the Big Red's future as they look to repeat?
Yeah, burst onto the scene as a freshman second half of that season, only added to it as a sophomore. We saw during championship weekend, and whether it was CJ Kirst or John Tillman, everyone was singing his praise after that championship triumph, because he's shifty, he's quick, he's a really aggressive feeder. He ended up with 50 assists to his 43 goals last year. So, you know, looking at those offensive weapons that they have, they're going to have to play even more off ball without a dynamic threat like losing your Tourton winner and CJ Kirst. But you add another guy that I'm high on that we'll get to a little bit, and this offense should be humming again with Goldstein at the center of it.
Number seven and number eight, two guys that we can kind of talk about a little bit in tandem. Caleb Fiak, the goalie at Ohio State, and eight, Bobby Van Buren, the lockdown defenseman. I was talking to a assistant coach about my list, and he was like, if you're basing this on last year and what we saw, Caleb Fiak should be number one. His ability to win games for the Buckeyes was as impactful as anybody else in college lacrosse. And I thought that was a really interesting take. And I also think it's really interesting in the context of the arc of Ohio State's season. This was, you know, a returning starter who didn't start the first half of the first game. It ultimately turned out to be a loss to Utah, which in retrospect is one of the biggest outlier results. And then as the season develops and he really, you know, fit into his own skin, what is such an interesting contrast between Fiak and the defense that plays in front of him is the yin yang elements of their approach. I think what makes Fiak such a good player is the looseness with which he plays, whereas I think defensively it's the tightness with which they play that is like so on a string. And you could assume that wouldn't work, right? That it would be a little bit competing, but I think anybody who watched that defense play last year would come away saying it did work and it was really complimentary. So Matt, Bobby Van Buren is a player that you've written a lot about over the course of the last several years, and somebody that I know you have a lot of affinity for his game. And I think that there's a lot about Van Buren, the senior, that's going to be really interesting. What's your take on Bobby at number eight?
Yeah, I mean, you would presume that Van Buren, you know, given his, you know, non-traditional background, he was homeschooled, you know, he definitely played club lacrosse and was a highly touted recruit, you know, by the time he got toward the end of his career. But you could presume with that and also coming off of injury from 2 years ago that he still hasn't really reached his peak as a lacrosse player. He might be the best guy, him, Schaller, and Light, but he might be the best guy like just covering a traditional ex-attackman. But I think last year you saw his ability to play off ball better. He's just adding more stuff to his toolkit. And like you said, with the way that Fiak is playing, and like Fiak like gives them some personality to their defense, and the way that Van Buren is like the steady hand, and then you add in Cullen Brown as well, and we'll get to him later. They all improve each other's stock in this top 50 rankings because they all make each other better.
And that's important as a goalie, right? You want to have that, not that he doesn't care about letting goals in, but he's kind of unflappable when he gets scored on a couple times. It's no big deal. Led the, like you said, after sitting that first half of the season, or the first half of the first game of the season, ends up leading all Division One in save percentage, north of 61%. He takes up a lot of the goal, yes. Big, tasty, great personality, but he's so important for that Buckeye defense.
So continuing on at the defensive ends, Will Donovan, number nine, Notre Dame long stick midi, very complimentary with Light in terms of their ability to work up top and down low and really limit the opponent's top two offensive threats. Kev, I know Will's game is one that you've followed a lot. What was your take on that spot?
Yeah, whereas a lot of other long stick midfielders will get some notoriety and a lot of press for how much they score in transition, and we'll get to a guy who really can do that. On-ball ability from Will Donovan, it just takes the top midfielder out of every opposing offense that they play out of the game, and that's so important. His play on the wings is one of the best in the country. He ended up with only 24 ground balls last season. You'd expect a little more than that, but overall, just he makes a lot of plays. He was so important for both those titles. And listen, it wasn't a huge drop off. Like, yeah, they lost a sizable lead in that quarterfinal game, but they're still a top 10 defense. And in terms of efficiency and in our numbers, but Donovan is definitely a big reason for that. And it's a good shot. He's a perfect pair with John White down at close.
At number 10, Brady Wambach, faceoff guy for North Carolina. Dan, you spoke a minute ago about Owen Duffy, and Wambach is going to be the guy feeding him the ball. The best faceoff guy in college lacrosse is an insanely valuable weapon for a team with aspirations like what the Tar Heels have. Missed the tournament 2 years ago, make the tournament, but lose in the first round in 2025. Clearly, the goal is at least to win a game, if not two, maybe even three, if not four, in 2026. What are your thoughts on the role that Wambach's going to play in that?
I mean, yeah, he's a big reason why I think a lot of people are bullish on the Tar Heels. And, you know, if he can give Owen Duffy in that offense 70% possession in every single game, that's just like, how do we lose, right? Like, it's really comes down to that. And I think it's interesting that he's actually a number 10 and that the next faceoff guy on the list is actually at 25, I believe. I won't reveal his name right now, but it's interesting because I think that there's three guys in the conversation. I'm not going to mention them all right now that are in contention for that title as best faceoff guy in the country. So it's interesting to see to me that Wambach won that somewhat decisively.
I would add that what I think about Wambach's role and the way in which he's either competing or separated himself from competition is what Carolina has done with Parker Hoffman. Another highly touted faceoff guy coming out of high school. And Wambach became like a, you know, yeoman in terms of the percentage of Carolina's faceoffs that he took, but they still felt like there was value and a way in which to get Hoffman on the field, which was converting a high school faceoff guy into a wing guy. And that's pretty much the only role that he plays and was, you know, really potent off the wing offensively with 6 goals and an assist. And so I think that the complementary nature of their game is super compelling, but also underscores exactly how effective Wambach is as a faceoff guy. If you look down your bench and you say, we've got this guy, Parker Hoffman, who can contribute, but we're going to put him on the wing as opposed to having him take a third or so of the faceoffs because we don't want Wambach not taking those faceoffs. Keeping it rolling, number 11, Mikey Weishaar. Matt, I'm going to go to you with this one. Again, you've spent a lot of time watching Towson practice over the last couple of years. You've covered a handful of Tiger games. Weishaar, Kevin, you mentioned earlier, was a highly touted pro prospect. He's the first non-power conference selection. He's coming off of a year in which he moved from midfield to attack full-time. What are your projections and outlook for Wambach in 2026? I'm sorry, for Weishaar in 2026.
Yeah, I saw them in the fall, and I mean, he looked like Mikey Weishaar. You know what I mean? Like, he's just like, he's one of those guys that there's an excitement every time he touches the ball. It's the way he plays. He's so explosive, and you just kind of like, you know, he has that reckless abandon to him where like, oh, is he going to just like dart to the net and get hit theatrically and still score? He's one of those guys. So he just adds an excitement to that Towson offense. But I think that the thing that raises his ceiling is some of the pieces that Towson has on offense coming back. You have Ronan Fitzpatrick, who emerged as like, you know, this really awesome goal scoring redshirt freshman last year. And now you have Joaquin Villagomez, who's coming back from injury. You know, he probably will be a midfielder. You know, I think some of the positions are a little gray there, but he's got so much size and is going to be able to bully guys in a way that's going to allow Weishaar to just use his explosiveness. And, you know, I think he'll play an attack again. And he was at 48 goals last year. I see more than 50 this year.
Another really quick, shifty offensive player, Nate Kibiri, coming in at number 12. Princeton's leading returning scorer as they said goodbye to Coulter McAsee, who joined the PLL, and that creates a hole on the left side of their offense. But Kibiri is the righty and the quarterback. Kev, I'm going to throw this one to you because I know you got thoughts on the Tiger offense and Nate's role in it.
Yeah, he's a super well-rounded player, very balanced stat line last year, 32 goals, 29 assists. Pretty flashy at times. We've seen the behind-the-back catches on socials. But his ability to impact how the offense runs next year is going to be so important because he is going to take on those number one defensive assignments for the first time in his career as a junior. And that's probably the only reason he lies just outside of the top 10 going into this season in our aggregated rankings. You know, there's something to prove there. And we'll see if he steps up to the plate. We know he has the talent and skill set to do so.
I actually think that of all the players on this list, Nate Kibiri, especially amongst attackmen, might meet the best, like, low angle, make something happen, whether it's an assist or score. Like, he just is clinical from, like, just above goal line extended. With Princeton, like, there isn't a huge drop-off expected from Coulter McAsee's graduation, and I think Kibiri is probably the prime reason for that. It's going to be really interesting to see how he fits into the offense, because there's a few other guys on this list from Princeton who we think are either going to be as good as last year or a lot better, and how do they fit into an offense with him?
Number 13 is Cullen Brown, Ohio State defenseman. Matt, you mentioned him earlier. I'm going to take this one because I love talking about the distinction between your lockdown traditional on-ball defender, which Bobby Van Buren clearly is, and then your number two guy who is tasked a little bit more with some of the off-ball stuff, some of the playmaking stuff, whether it be causing turnovers or picking up ground balls, and the balance that those two guys have to have in their game in the way that they, create defensive stops. And for me, Brown is one of the chief examples of not only how important it is, but how striking the value prop between the two can be really challenging. Cullen Brown was number 7 among long poles in our fantasy production rankings last season, which, for those of you unfamiliar, we basically value each cause turnover at 6 points, each ground ball at 3 points. And then in addition to the goals and assists that they score. And Cullen Brown averaged 3.5 ground balls per game and a little bit more than 2 cause turnovers per game. That level of production is not off the charts because, like I said, he was number 7, but it's really, really impressive. And when you combine it with his physicality and his ability to match feet with the right matchups off of opponents' offense, to me, it just creates an all-around defenseman that I think can fly under the radar because the traditional value is for that lockdown corner who can hold an offensive player that comes in averaging 5 or 6 points a game to, 0-0 ideally, 1-1 probably a little bit more realistically. And that's not Brown in this Ohio State defense, but I do think that he provides a lot of other value outside of it. Number 14, Silas Richmond. An absolutely enormous offensive presence for the Albany Great Danes, and somebody, Matt, that I know that you're pretty familiar with, so I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, enormous, in production and in size as well. He's a giant out there on the field. The thing that I love is just that, as he's gotten more pieces around him on offense, he's been able to utilize those pieces in such a great way. You look at his freshman year, 2023, 34 goals and 7 assists. I think he was basically maybe dismissed as like a highlight reel guy, right? He's going to be the guy that you're going to have this crazy goal, but like, is he really a complete attackman? And I think he's proven in the past 2 years, last year he had 43 goals and 46 assists. That's just a tremendous turnaround from 2 years ago. He's got a lot of pieces around him. And, Albany, this offense is kind of stacked. When you look at, I think they have something like 6 or 7 of their top guys returning on offense, Ryan Doherty, Jackson Palem, Colton Marquis, all guys who are like, and Richmond is just at the center of it all, making everybody better. He's got size. He's got that, like, he's going to be good for one ridiculous play every game, but he's a more well-rounded attackman than people give him credit for.
Yeah, I think with Silas Richmond, I think there's a guy on every single team who can kind of do something crazy in practice. He's the kind of guy that does something crazy in the game. You're like, wow. Very few guys can actually pull it off, the stuff that he does and those kind of high pressure situations that he finds himself in. But to your point, like, you showed me the assist numbers that he had last year, and I was honestly kind of surprised, because I think when everybody looks at him, they think of, like, this is the guy you see doing crazy stuff on Instagram. But it's not that at all. He's actually a much more balanced player than I think a lot of people give him credit for. And like you said, I think Albany's due for a big year with some of the offensive guys that they're coming back, and he's their headliner. So they'll be a fun team to watch, I think, this year.
Well, which, before we move on, to your point about him being enormous on the field, did you realize he was 6'4"? Like, I certainly didn't, because of the way he kind of glides out there, beats his matchups, and with those fancy backhands and behind the backs, like,
yeah,
he really does have it all.
Yeah, for a guy who's like, his player comp is probably like sand handling, I guess. Like, he doesn't look it. Like, he's not like a bulky, slow guy at all. He makes things look so effortless and seamless and just fun and free-flowing. And I think that's a lot of that's credit to Albany and Scott Moore and their philosophy they have on offense. So it's like, props to him for, you know, cultivating that type of player and allowing that type of freedom. So,
Kev, going to stay with you at number 15, Evan Plunkett, Army midfielder. I feel like if we gave anybody else the opportunity to talk about Plunkett, you'd be upset, because he's one of your favorite players and has been for quite some time. Georgia native, his brother is another contributor on this Black Knight offense, a team that's going to have some questions heading into 26 as they graduate their best player at pretty much every level other than the midfield where Plunkett returns. What were your thoughts on what he does and what he means to Joel Berichu's team?
Yeah, so athletic. He's everywhere all the time. And he's so important to how the offense runs, because he beats his guy. He gets the defense rotating. And look, I struggled with this ranking because, as you mentioned, I am such a big Evan Plunkett fan. And you go down 18 points from the prior season. We had him number 11 going into the 2025 season. So he drops a few spots, and if deserved with the drop in production. But you can expect him to up that tally again going into 26, because he's, as I said, going into last season, he's one of the best passing midfielders, such a great playmaker. And he can get a shot off at any time. So I know with his work ethic, he's up at 4 a.m. every day, and he's beating the drum and running up those hills to get back at it. So it'll be fascinating to see just how much they want to run through him, with Hill, his younger brother, being more of a quarterback down at attack.
I was going to shout you out for the pun with the running up those hills, given that his brother's name is Hill. I'm going to stick with number 16, Willem Firth, left-handed attackman for Cornell, presumed to step into the role that CJ Kirst vacated. Firth is potentially arguably the linchpin for Cornell's prospective success offensively, because he's the most known quantity in the context of being their leading midfield scorer in on this national championship team in 2025. And if he can seamlessly step down to attack, increase his production commensurately with the amount of time that he has on the field, the transition opportunities that weren't available to him when he was playing midfield, and presumably not only his own internal improvement, but also the improved chemistry with Ryan Goldstein from the standpoint of their increased familiarity as attack line mates, then you can imagine a scenario in which this top five offense that the Big Red have stays a top five offense. And without that, you know, there are questions, right? The other end of the field in terms of what they graduate, you know, what they lose from a defensive coordinator standpoint. We can be confident in Cornell's ability to get the ball based on what they bring back at the faceoff. So for me, if they stay a top five offense, then their floor is somewhere in between what we saw in 2024 and 2025, right? 24, their defense was in the 30s and they weren't a national championship contender. In 25, their defense was in the high teens and they won the national championship. So The question is whether or not their offense can remain a top five unit. And for me, Willem Firth, who, you know, we've spoken and written about since he was a top 10 recruit and one of the really interesting players in his recruiting class because he was fairly late on the scene and a fairly late commit, is again, for me, one of the most interesting players to talk about when you head into 2026.
I still can't fathom just the luxury of reigning champion with graduating your Tour Thon winner to go from CJ Kirsch to basically another Jeff Teat is pretty crazy. So I'm almost overcompensating for how much, you know, I undervalued Teat during his college days. So I'm like, I'm all in on Willem Firth. I think I had him the highest on any bout.
Yeah, I think it's not just the number 51 that he wears that reminds you of Teat. It's just like the ability, like obviously they're Canadian. Obviously they have great feeding skills, but I think it's the ability to anticipate movements on offense that are two or three steps or two or three passes away, right? Like, and I think that's been one of the great strengths of Cornell's offense over the past couple of years, going back to Teat. It's just the ability to move the ball so quickly and still stay coordinated and stay on schedule, so to speak, of, you know, finding that guy when he gets open and, you know, having a slam dunk right in front of the cage. And I think Willem Firth is just the guy who fits into that puzzle with Goldstein that makes that offense really go. Let's see if he can match CJ Kirsch production numbers, though, because it's tough, even with a guy who we compare to Jeff Teat all the time. So,
well, and one of the things about it is that regardless, on the left side of Cornell's offense, you're going to go from a guy who's 6'1", 6'2", 215-ish to a guy who's 5'9", 165, 170. And with number 17 on the list, we're going with somebody who's 6'5", 220, 230 pounds. Eric Spanos, the attackman for Maryland. A lot of interesting questions at Maryland's attack as they return Spanos and Braden Erksa, as well as welcome in Leo Johnson on the left side and Chris Lyons from Yale. Matt, what are your thoughts on Spanos at number 17?
Well, you mentioned his size, and I think this past year was the first time he played like his size dictates. There was like an increased assertiveness to his game, increased physicality. It just felt like he had grown into his size and his role as like the guy for Maryland's offense. And I say the guy in the sense that Maryland was known all year as like, you know, this is the share of the ball offense. But to me, he was really the guy that kind of exemplified that. What was really interesting last year about Maryland is they kept the same lineup throughout the entire course of the year, which is weird for Maryland. They're a team that has been known to, you know, you look at 2 years prior, they made significant changes to their offense like the week ahead of the NCAA tournament. So I think the fact that Spanos grew into that just like consistency, like alpha focal point role was the reason that they had this stability. And he provides that again. The cast around him is going to be really interesting with, like you said, the transfers coming in from Yale. Where does Erksa fit? They have so many guys that, like, you know, there's going to be some shuffling off. But I think he just remains this consistent force now that he's kind of grown into his, like, you know, grown to his own body, so to speak.
Yeah. And it's, like you said, like Maryland has unapologetically like tinkered with personnel over the years. And it is weird that they didn't mix it up last year. But this year they definitely are, because there's just too much talent, you know, coming in on that offense. And, you know, we discussed this, I think, around the time that the Cornell-Maryland fall ball game. It's like there's an odd man out at attack. And like one of those guys has to play midfield. Is it Eric Spanos? I don't know.
I don't think it is, for what it's worth. I would say that Spanos and Johnson are the two most likely, and I think that Erksa and Lyons are the two most likely to probably, and part of the reason I feel this way is because it's what happened in the Maryland-Harvard scrimmage, but flip-flop at attack and midfield and see, you know, basically who performs best in each role. Kev, I want to go to you. We've got a run of defensemen here as we finish up the top 20. At number 18, another Richmond Spider, Hunter Smith, a player that you are well familiar with. What are your thoughts on Mr. Smith?
Yeah, he's another one of these erasers that are just so elite coming into the 2026 season. So important for how efficient the Spiders were on that end. And, you know, fair even, 27 calls turnovers, 27 ground balls. Unranked going into last season, he was kind of just on the edge of breaking out as one of these top tier defensemen, and he really showed it with his performances against CJ Kurse both times that they played. They play a very great schedule, and it showcases how he can match up against both really quick attackmen and also the physical guys as well. And, you know, it's kind of a perfectly built defense around him as well. Last season, they don't lose too much. They have a new goalie and a third defenseman that'll have to step up, but Hunter Smith as a co-captain and stepping up as a leader this offseason is going to be vital for their success.
And to me, Smith is in that category of a lockdown guy, less so of that, you know, kind of playmaker, ground ball, cause turnover guy that we talked about in the context of Colin Brown. These last two guys at 19 and 20 are two of the better guys in terms of fitting both criteria, right? Being excellent on ball defenders, but also good playmakers for their defense overall. Number 19, Georgetown defenseman Ty Banks. Matt, your thoughts?
Canadian superstar for, you know, the next several years of world game cycles and stuff like that. Out of Georgetown. So, you know, who does that remind you of? He came in and he started right away at a kind of an All-America level. His sophomore year, he did even better. He's aggressive on the ball. He's caused 22 turnovers last year. He's also like this guy that, like, when you watch him play box, you know, back-to-back Minto Cup champion, watch him play sixes. You know, he played in the Atlas Cup. He's so good with the short stick. It just really reveals just like how good his like nose for, just making plays is, you know, both with long stick, short stick, the way he can get out there and run. Just love him. And he's like that kind of menace that you want on your team, right? Like, he's the guy that's going to disrupt something. And the fact that, like, they've got such a good goalie, good pieces around them, he's part of the reason why pretty high on Georgetown this year.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, there's that, what is it, Friday Night Lights, Booby Miles, like, that boy can flat out play football. Like, this guy is just a flat out great lacrosse player. Like, you give him a short stick in college lacrosse, and I'm sure he finds a way to make an impact, right? Like, he's just so good, not only at close defense, but he can also push transition between the lines. That defense, I think, is, you know, more so than the Connor brothers coming into Georgetown, is going to be a big reason why Georgetown's going to have a lot of success in 2026. So,
and checking in at number 20, Penn State defenseman Alex Ross. For me, a really interesting story of evolution over the course of his career, whereas coming out of high school, I think both in terms of like his scholastic and club setting, I always thought about him a little bit more as that number two defenseman. I remember, you know, watching him in club and being so impressed by his vocal communication, his ability to get his teammates aligned to work with Caleb Fayok in order to do that. But I also felt like as he has emerged at Penn State, where there's this lineage of really great on-ball players, he has taken number one matchups and won them against players who probably came in a little bit more highly regarded than he was in terms of that one-on-one mentality. Kev, do you have any thoughts on Alex Ross?
Yeah, you're spot on. I think his evolution as an eraser in the Division I landscape, we had him kind of neck and neck in terms of impact on winning and the that really good efficient defense for Penn State with Kevin Parnum last year. And I really think Kevin Parnum was more of that number two guy and Ross more of the eraser. And Ross's just impact on just hustle plays and taking guys out of the game. 24 cost turnovers, 31 ground balls. We had him at number 29 last season. So he takes a good leap. And listen, I had him all the way up in my top five, splitting hairs with Will Schaller, because I think he's right up in that conversation.
Yeah, he's definitely, he gets the Rodney Dangerfield award this year of just like the no respect in terms of, there's so many great defensive guys, right? That's the theme of this whole process that we're doing there. But, you know, you have to consider him with Schaller and Light for all the reasons that you guys have stated. Penn State had the number five adjusted defensive efficiency last year. Remember, he was on CJ Kurse for, you know, maybe not the entire game, but a big chunk of that game where, you know, Kurse was held scoreless in the quarterfinals. Granted, the whole storyline after that became, is he hurt? What's his status or whatever? But also the fact Alex Ross was playing him and playing him very well. And, you know, Parnum and Ross kind of in that regular season game, you know, remember Penn State beat Cornell.
Wait.
So this is a guy who can handle the best of the best. you don't get any better than CJ Kirst, and he can handle that.
We're each going to talk about a guy that we think is a little underrated, a guy that we think is a little rated a little too highly, and then a snub. But before we do that, the group of 21 to 25 is just too interesting not to talk about. So we'll talk about, I'm gonna read them off quickly, and then we can each pick a guy that we want to quickly address. Number 21, Hunter Aquino, attack slash midfield, Penn State. That's part of what makes him interesting. Number 2, McCabe Millen, attack, Virginia. Number 23, Ben Johnston, midfielder out of Duke, again, probably. Number 24, midfielder, Matt Collison, Johns Hopkins. And number 25, faceoff specialist, Syracuse, John Mulling. Darren, you get to go first. Who do you want to talk about?
Of these 21 to 25 guys?
Yeah.
Let's talk about Hunter Aquino, because I, for one, am honestly shocked that we have him as a 21st ranked player in college lacrosse after the freshman season, right? Like, I just think that's, like, not that he's not a bad player or anything like that. I'm just surprised to see him that high. Like I think there's everyone at this table agrees that he's a great player, is a great size mismatch. But the 21st player, like, I think that's going to be something that people look at and say, wow, like, they are really high on him this year.
I was going to have him as my guy who is underrated on this list. So, you know, we're kind of on different wavelengths here. I had him at number 11 in my list. I saw him in the fall, so maybe there's some recency bias. But I'm kind of stealing a point that you made, Terry, on our Slack, was just that if he is playing attack, and that's a big if, you know, he was kind of doing that as an experiment for Penn State. He could run out of the box. You know, there's a lot of things. But if he is going to just toast guys off the end line on restarts with his size, like, that makes him so, like, there's not many attackmen who can do that.
You can't slide to him. You cannot slide to a guy who's 6'5", 220 pounds, running off the end line with a 10 to 15 yard head start, and you have to make contact with him at GLE or within a yard or two above GLE. Otherwise, he is going to get his hands free. And as we saw when he was dodging from up top, he is a very willing and accurate passer, and Penn State's going to have a lot of really good finishers on the backside, regardless of which hand he's dodging with. And that's once you let him not shoot. So, yeah, it would be a terror for sure.
He is known to destroy defenders at GLE. Like, there's just going to be carnage when he's coming off the end line. So I had him a lot higher. Maybe I'm skewing the voting a little bit just through my voting. But he's the guy that I have it as underrated, but he's in that 21 to 25 group.
Kev, who do you want to talk about?
I'll give some kudos to Syracuse faceoff man John Mullen. Only Jack Cascaden, who's a little further down the list, took more faceoffs, won more faceoffs. John Mullen at 63%, a couple percentage points above him. He is an all-around faceoff guy. He can win it and counter in really every direction and manner. But his ability to win it forward and spark offense, transition, score himself, or set up Joyce Pleen at the point is going to be really a big tool for this orange group.
All right, I'll take the red meat. I'm going to talk about McCabe Millen. For me, I think there was probably a little bit too much of a he's not as good as we thought he was reaction to his sophomore season. That was a function, in my opinion, of a combination of two factors. Virginia's limited talent in their fifth and sixth spots, and then 7, 8, 9 as you get into depth, whether it be in-game depth or season-long injury depth. And also the transition from being a freshman who was guarded by opponent's third best long stick in most instances, although obviously that got a little bit switched up in the context of when they would double-hole Virginia and put a short stick on Peyton Cormier, to the guy who then has not only opponent number one, but also is number one on opponent's scouting report. And so I felt like there was always going to be built-in, not regression, but a built-in plateau because of that increased burden. And when I look at Virginia in 2026, I see a lot of what we saw out of Carolina transitioning from 24 to 25 and Syracuse from 23 to 24. There is built-in improvement by virtue of a combination of the infusion of talent and the way it's going to take some of that pressure off of Millen, as well as his own understanding of what the demands are of being the number one offensive player, in addition to which some of the best opposing defensemen that he went against and gave him problems last year are no longer playing college lacrosse because they graduated. So, like, While we've talked about it, he's going to be guarded by a lot of great defensemen like Will Schaller and Sean Light, and the list goes on and on. I do expect Millen to, you know, take another step forward, and I'm really excited to see what it looks like and what the ceiling is going to be defined as.
I think some people will think it's interesting that he's ranked at 22. Maybe he's thinking that's a little low, but I think that's a function of Virginia not having a great season last year. Because I think when you look at McCabe's numbers, they're really not as bad as like the whole idea that he has regressed would suggest, right? Like, I still think he was one of the more effective players in the ACC. But I think for Virginia, like, they're getting a lot of guys back from injury. But I think everybody is going to watch how he interacts with his brother Brendan, because I think that when those two guys are together, they play roles that are more authentic to themselves and to how they want to play. Like, I feel like for a bit of last year, McCabe was put into a role that he wasn't necessarily familiar or, you know,
has suited for.
Best suited for, yeah. Like, and I feel like with Brendan coming in, a guy who can be a little bit more of a quarterback, like, that's going to open up a little bit more of McCabe to be more of like a dodge to set up your own shot kind of guy, which I felt like when he was at McDonough and we saw a lot of his games, he really excelled at. And you know, you add in a couple of guys coming back from injury and a few other freshmen coming in. Like, I think that this team is due for a bounce back. How much do they bounce back, I think, is the question for me.
It's really well said. Just, you cannot understate that importance of Brendan coming into the fold. And I'll just throw this out, that Connor Schellenberger also coming back on staff this year, to mentor both of them is going to be huge.
All right, Matt. Who on this list do you think is underranked, understanding that you would have gone with Hunter Aquino if we didn't already talk
about it? I rated Jack Spiedel a lot higher. Obviously, he's a returning All-American. He's a do-it-all guy. And I think when you watch the USA U20 team, you know, he led them in scoring. He wasn't even invited to the original selection camp. And he just kind of willed his way in there and added to the team right before the event and just did a little bit of everything. Great rider. Can score inside, can cut off ball. Just, you know, he's the best rider on the best riding team in the country. So I think his impact goes beyond his point production. And he's going to be, you know, really a key part to a Harvard team that is going to look different on offense, obviously. But, you know, I still think he has tremendous upside.
The way to do this exercise and have it be like a pure answer is to look at my vote side by side with the final vote and be like, okay, that's where the biggest distance was. Hand up, I'm not going to do that. I voted Josh Yago as number 39, and he came in at number 32, which should suggest that when I look at the list, I wouldn't say like Josh Yago, he's the guy who is too low. And yet, as I look at the list, that's the reaction that I have, because the role that he's going to play and how important he is going to be is really hard to overstate. Notre Dame has solidified itself as a national championship or bust level program. And this is the opportunity to see what that offense looks like without Chris Kavanaugh and Jake Taylor. And if it's going to be a national championship quality offense, the Air Force transfer is going to be a part of the reason why. You could justify being a little low on him because of the lingering injury issues through the fall and potentially for the integration issues of being a grad transfer at Notre Dame. I don't think the grad transfer point carries much water because we've already seen grad transfers come in and be incredibly influential in Notre Dame winning national championships. I understand they're not at Tappan, but with that being said, the thing that gives me makes me most bullish for Yago in 26 was something that I heard, which is that nobody at Notre Dame practices has as consistently given Sean Light challenges in one-on-ones over the last 3 years as Josh Yago. And for me, that means something. And so that's my guy who I think is, if not underrated or underranked, is the guy who I think as the season goes along, and if we do this exercise at the end of the year, might be the one who's the most high.
Dan? I'm going to go with Colin Cardilla. He came in at 34 at our list. I ranked him number 18, and I just think that when you look at how Rutgers finished the season last year, and you also look at how Cardilla played with the USA team this past summer, like, I just think he's a freaking awesome player. Like, he's got the size, he's got the shooting ability. He's just a fantastic offensive dynamic player. And I feel like if Rutgers is going to bounce back from that kind of like disappointing first half of the season that they had last year, he is going to be the reason why. Him and Carden Stoller, who is also on this list. And I just think that, yeah, like I was shocked to not see him in like the mid-20s. Like I think that he is going to establish himself in his junior year as one of the best players in college lacrosse.
Kev?
Decent shout. Gentlemen, I am shocked that these two players were as low as they were. I'm higher on the Connor brothers than I think the rest of the staff here. They ended up in the 25 to 30 range. I had them as top 10 players coming off a Patriot League title with Colgate. They both make the switch over to the Big East to Georgetown. Liam Connor, fourth in points per game. Rory, seventh, both around 5 points per game. Rory, that kind of quarterback, lefty, kind of can operate in the wing or at X. He's so good at facilitating and seeing the offense as a former high school football quarterback. Liam, on the other hand, the former high school basketball standout, you can really just tell because he's got that size. He's seen over top of the defense, and he's moving the ball really well. It's difficult to say really who's better than who. I think they're right there. They're kind of tied in my mind. But they're both coming into a Georgetown attack unit that loses solo captain named Carroll and a vastly improved Fulton Bayman from last season. So they have two roles to fulfill in that offense, and they've got really, really gifted skill sets in terms of how can they can produce.
I think that they probably caused voters the most fits because I know for me personally, like I just felt like you had to group them together, like right next to each other, because it's like who's better, like who's more impactful. Like I couldn't make the distinction. So it's like, yeah, I think that they're probably a little bit lower on this list because I think people struggled like where do I place them as individuals instead of like as a pair, right? But yeah, they're going to be huge for Georgetown and probably one of the big reasons why people are so bullish on that team. So
Matt, who's too high?
Who is ranked too high? Okay. The guy that I rated most lower compared to his rating in this top 50 is Schomburg, the goalie at Army. And I think my thought process there is not a slight against Byrne, but I'm curious how Army's defense is going to be overall. AJ Pilot, Christian Fournier, Christian Mazur are all gone. Yeah, those are three guys who you stated earlier, some of the best at their individual positions are now gone. How much, you know, with goalie and defense, it's kind of that yin yang thing of like, how much did Sean Byrne make those guys look really good? How much did those guys make Sean Byrne look really good?
And not only that, but also with Vokaletti gone, how much more pressure is the defense going to be under by virtue of how much more defense is going to have to play?
Exactly. So Army is one of those teams that I think I ranked everyone that I had on this list, you know, Plunkett, Sean Byrne. I think I kind of dipped them down a little bit from maybe what some of the expectations were, just because I think there's enough question marks around that program to have a little bit of skepticism.
I'm going to do the same thing with the overrated as I did with the underrated, which is defy my own vote. So Peter Bonanno came in at number 27. I had him at number 19. I know that I had a large influential voice in communicating to our staff after some of the conversations that I had with folks around Princeton coming away from the fall in terms of the role that Bonanno was going to fill. So replacing Coulter Mackesy, it would seem that that responsibility would fall to either Chad Palumbo or Bonanno. And my gut is that the sophomore is going to take the attack spot for a couple reasons. Number one, Kevin, you made this point, so I'll give credit to you, but a little bit more bang for your buck in terms of he's got 3 years of eligibility left. And then the other reason to do it is because Palumbo's role in midfield is very clearly defined, right? It's kind of the idea of when an offensive lineman gets hurt, it's a bad thing to move one offensive lineman into the role of the injured player because then you have two new guys, right? Whereas, you know, if you keep Palumbo in that midfield spot where he's played at an All-American level and put Bonanno in at the attack spot. But the reason I think he's my answer for this question is because I think a lot of folks are going to look at number 27 as a guy who hasn't started yet and be like, really? Wow. But I guess it's a bet, right? And, you know, we're not It's not exclusively looking backwards, right? If this were based exclusively on prior performance, we would just take last year's All-America list, take out the guys who aren't back, and then rank them that way. It's not that. It's a list that includes more projection. And so that's why I think people are going to be a little surprised when they see Pinano as high as he is.
And Princeton is a team that I think when you use that word projection, right? There's question marks around every team. You know, the big theme of this is just that there isn't a true favorite for the national title. There's not a true favorite to be the number one player in the country. There's just not like that definitive statement you can make about the season. Princeton, though, I feel like their losses, guy like Colter Mackesy, and then on the defensive end as well, there's a clear sight line to how they will fill those roles. They also have a clear track record of how they've done, you know, how they've replaced guys. They had a series of good recruiting classes. So even though there are question marks, it feels like there are more answers at Princeton than there are at other teams in the country.
Dan.
Well, I was going to say Bonanno, so, but I'm surprised to see Ben Johnson at 23, and I think that's not really a slight against him, but like I asked the question, where's Max Sloat? Because I feel like at points during Duke's season last year, I thought Max Sloat was their best offensive player. Like, they fit him into attack, and I thought he worked great there for a couple of weeks, and then you know, he may have had a bad game here or two, and they said, hey, let's send him back to midfield. But, like, I just think going into Duke's season next year, like, I would be much higher on Max Sloat than, you know, he's not even on this top 50. Like, I think that he belongs in this top 50. And it's not to say that Ben Johnson shouldn't be at 23, but it's like, I think that both him and Max Sloat are the engines that run that Duke offense. And I think that they should be perceived in, like, the same hemisphere. I don't think that they are.
Kev, who you got?
Yeah, it's a fair shout. I had similar feelings about Mac Hollison. I kept dropping him back in my ballot, although I think he's uber talented and going to be super important for that Hopkins crew. Kind of the opposite reaction of a guy everyone maybe expected to be on the list, ended up there at 40, Don Petromala. He's good for a hat trick a game. I just value more quarterback type players that couple guys who didn't make the list, such as Ohio State's Garrett Haas, Penn State's Kyle Lehman, you know, not as gaudy numbers as Petromala's 48 goals, which kind of matched 48 goals, 3 assists. You look at Ohio State's Alex Bernier, didn't get many votes, 50 goals, 2 assists. So real sharpshooters, but a guy like Teddy Malone, Aiden O'Neill. These are some of the attackmen that I ranked ahead of him that were just outside of my top 50.
Matt, your snub.
I had so many snubs that I guess I'll try to limit it to one, but if you want to circle back, I might have a few others as well. The Big East as a conference is snubbed in this, just basically the Georgetown guys that we mentioned. Jake Melchione, LSM at Villanova, is a guy that I had late in my 40s. But you could also say, like, does someone like Grayson Manning, because of the way he played this summer, even though, you know, granted, he doesn't have the college experience and track record as some of the other goalies in his position, or Cody Mowalski, you know, are they guys who should have gotten the list? I had Jake Melchione. He's an excellent off the ground, creates a lot of transition. There's something to be said about a Villanova LSM. You know, it's a position of strength for them that they've had for years. But I've got a bunch of guys as well. So he's one of them. The Big East in general is one of them. But I will defer to the floor for some other snubs before I take over the microphone too much.
I'm going to go with Logan Ipp. For me, he was really in contention for that midfielder of the year spot last year. He fits the comment that I made about just a broad-based statistical production, caused turnovers, ground balls, in addition to goals and assists. And, you know, certainly plays on a really good six-man offensive unit. So, you know, I think he benefits from maybe some of the burden, especially last year, that a guy like Sam Kane carry. But for me, Logan Ipp is a top 50 player.
That I deferred because he was the guy that he was my number one guy before I switched. I had him at 42.
Yeah, Ipp is a great shout. I'm going to offer up two names. One, my first one is AJ Marsh. Like, I felt like I've seen him play at Navy, and I just think that he is a fantastic player. And I I think that he may suffer from visibility. Like, I just don't think a lot of people watch Navy lacrosse as much and therefore don't know how great of a player he is, but I think he's outstanding. And then to go into the contrarian vein, I think I was the only person to vote for Jack Wagnari from Tufts. Like, there's no parameters provided here, so why can't a Division III player be included as the top 50 players in the college lacrosse? Like, I think that, you know, we've seen players go from D3 to the PLL and be great players. We've seen them transfer into places like Virginia and other great schools in the ACC and Big Ten and fit right in. And it's just like, well, why can't we consider this guy for, you know, as one of the best players in college lacrosse?
Love it.
That, if I'm gonna interject here because I did not put him, I will preface that, but serious consideration to Kyle Lewis at Adelphi, the midfielder of the year in D2, ice in his veins, won the national championship with his overtime goal. He was a guy who went to the transfer portal this year and committed to Penn State for a series of about 7 2-hours before he decided to go back to Adelphi. Syracuse was in the mix. Rutgers is in the mix. There was a lot of teams who really wanted his services. He's just like that guy who didn't really go full-time in lacrosse until late in his high school career. So the fact that he's the best midfielder of the country in Division II lacrosse, if he was on a D1 roster, he would certainly be a first-line midfielder at a top-tier school.
And that's where I'm coming from is, like, if Jack Wagnari and Kyle Lewis enter the portal, like, a ton of schools would be interested in him, right? So it's like, that's the kind of, like, the framework I'm working from, and, like, that's why I voted for Wagnari. Kevin, let's go over to you.
I stuck with Division I teams that, you know, made it to maybe a quarterfinal or a goal away from championship weekend. I was kind of beating the drum for a couple Beware the Spider guys here with Richmond. A midfielder, Joe Sheridan, only a handful of guys produced 40 points from the midfield. Sheridan was one of them. He was just outside the top 10 in shooting percentage. He worked his butt off to improve his shot in the offseason going into last year and was rewarded. He's kind of the focal point of that midfield with a couple surrounded by two step-down shooters that graduated. So he's going to have another big year. But the guy I was really harping on was Lucas Littlejohn. The best hands in the game, the interior finisher, north of the border. And for as much work as you did, Terry, as explaining Jake Taylor's impact on winning, I think he is in that same stratosphere in terms of he's such an accurate finisher. He was a couple percentage points below Jake Taylor, but still seventh in Division I last season. And it's just so, like, exhilarating how quick he gets it out of his stick, just in terms of how many times they jam it into him at the end of the shot clock. But that really opens up things for the rest of that Richmond offense. And they were top five in efficiency, and just how deep they made it last year. I thought he deserved the shout.
That'll do it for our discussion of the top 50 players. Next time we talk around this table, the college lacrosse season will be in sight. Fellas, thanks so much for your time. Thanks, everybody who watched and listened.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.